PR Radio, its staff, management, or sponsor.
Morning Edge on WWPR 1490 AM with Jay Augustus and Henry Rain. Sharpen your edge. Call the Morning Edge 941-745-1490. Now, here's Augie.
Well, it's not quite Augie today. Augie has been called away on a special assignment. I'll be flying solo here this morning, at least until 9:20, when we speak with Gray Torrico Caceros at the Soros Justice Fellow and Enforcement Organizer of the Florida Immigrant Coalition. That sounds like a ominous title there, Enforcement Organizer. But we'll find out about that and more as she talks about the criminalization of Florida's immigrant communities and how do we stop it, and about some of the detentions that are going on there. But a look at some of the news that happened over the weekend. And I'm not just talking about Miley Cyrus at the Video Music Awards or the reuniting of Justin Timberlake and NSYNC, but thousands march on Washington, remember Martin Luther King's dream. The silhouettes of marching crowd appeared as soon as dawn broke over the Lincoln Memorial on Saturday. By the time the sun cast its first shadow over the Washington Monument's obelisk, thousands of people had lined the sides of the reflective pool. 50th anniversary celebration of the March on Washington, which culminated in 1963 with Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, had taken over the city. There were concerts, exhibitions, seminars, town hall rallies, and church services. "This is not the time for nostalgic commemoration," said Martin Luther King III, the oldest son of the civil rights leader. "Nor is this the kind for self-congratulatory celebration. The task is not done. Journey is not complete. We can and we must do more." Well, I don't know if you were watching that. I tried to watch the highlights and quite a bit of it. I saw them wheel out Reverend Lowry towards the end of Al Sharpton's speech. I saw some of the other speakers, and I thought it was a little incongruous to have Crystal Ball, the MSNBC host, act as moderator on parts of the festivities that I watched. But it was also interesting to see the Reverend Al Sharpton as acting, I guess, as the keynote speaker. At least that was my impression by watching the replay on C-SPAN. One of the other things is, just as a personal observation of Reverend Al Sharpton, you know the weight that he has lost over the last several years. When you look at him on MSNBC and you see the head and shoulders shot. But when you see him standing in a full profile, top to bottom, head to toe, it's really an amazing sight. He's almost too thin. He almost looks frail when you see him from a side view in his suit. I'm not saying that he is. I'm just saying that he's extremely thin. And he never appeared to be a tall man in his more portly days, but you also just are struck by his size when he stands in a crowd of people, too, in just casual settings. One of the things about C-SPAN, of course, is they have a lot of just rolling camera of no particular thing except the people standing around, and you get to see how a person holds themselves, how they prepare for a moment in the spotlight when they're off camera, And that was an interesting observation of his. I don't have any comments particularly on how he appeared to be, but other than what I've already said about his stature and his weight. But here's a sample of what he had to say at the 60th anniversary. Excuse me. 50th anniversary. I have to work on my math here. Of the I Have a Dream speech.
Let me say to our young brothers and sisters, many that were on the program, we owe a debt to those that thought enough for you to put their lives on the line. We owe a debt to those that believed in us when we did not believe in ourselves. And we need to conduct ourselves in a way that respects that. Don't you ever think that men like Medgar Evers died to give you the right to be a hoodlum or to give you the right to be a thug. That is not what they gave their life about. We need to talk about how we address one another, how we respect one another. We need to teach our young folk, I don't care how much money they give you, don't disrespect your women. No matter what they promise you, make it clear that you know that Rosa Parks wasn't no hoe and Fannie Lou Hamer wasn't no bitch.
And that, of course, was the Reverend Al Sharpton at the 50th, boy, my math is rough on a Monday, 50th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech and the March on Washington. And what do you think? 941-745-1490. 941-745-1490. Here, Augie should be back on Wednesday. And just has an unexpected assignment that he had to take care of here on this Monday morning. And again, the guest coming up in just a few minutes, so your voices can be heard at 941-745-1490. Well, if you're watching the Sunday talk shows or some of the morning talk shows here around the dial, for those of you that can remember when TVs had a dial, around the remote push buttons, if you will, the chemical attack in Syria has gotten a lot of play. People wringing their hands, sucking their thumbs, dragging their knuckles about whether or not President Obama should take action. And, of course, right here on the Morning Edge, you've heard us talk over the last week and a half or so about some of the conflicting reports and some of the suspicions about what really did happen there in Syria, and what is going on? Well, we're going to have a chance to look at it a little bit more in depth after the guest comes on in just a few minutes. But it does seem that we aren't the only media outlet that has noticed there's a lot of conflicting information on who did what and whose fingers pointing at who. Here's from CNN.
The Syrian military began an offensive in the opposition-held district of Jobar in Damascus early Saturday morning. The government says as its troops were pushing forward, rebels unleashed chemicals on them. This soldier, who I spoke to as the battle was still raging, says he was there and tells me several of his comrades couldn't...
Now, this is supposedly another chemical weapons attack from the 1,300 that reported dead, civilians, children, etc., that got a lot of television coverage last week. This is actually dated for Sunday, August 25th, so I imagine they're talking about events in the previous 24 hours.
Breathe after the incident. We're not feeling well, he says, eyes burning, a lot of pain, and they took a lot of soldiers to the hospital. The Syrian opposition denies the claims, but Syrian state media has been airing video of what it says shows a rebel chemical weapons stash the army uncovered in the same area. The soldier I talked to claimed the military has been hit with chemicals in the past, and showed me gas masks he says the units have been outfitted with.
Now, the idea that you outfit your units with gas masks hardly seems like evidence that gas was used. And the supposed labs, if you will, or preparation points, it's basically just a big room, a very big room, and a lot of leftover things that if you were just to look at them in a video without any preparation, or some old cans and miscellaneous bags of white powder and things like that, which not to say it isn't what they're saying it is. It's just not exactly a factory impression. It's not exactly a overwhelming kind of weapons of mass destruction location, but certainly if you can produce stuff, and get it distributed, but it doesn't really seem like a high-tech kind of operation there that they were showing on state-run Syrian TV.
Jobar has been in rebel hands for more than a year, with the Syrian army trying to win it back. The troops showed me some of the recent battle damage.
This is as far as the military is going to let us go. We're actually on the front line in the district of Jobar. The area around us is controlled by the opposition. The military says in recent weeks it's been making gains here, but they claim that the use of chemical weapons by the opposition has been holding them up.
Syria's government and the opposition have been blaming each other for allegedly using chemical agents on the battlefield. Rebels holding the Assad regime responsible for the deaths of more than 1,300 civilians in a massive chemical weapons attack, and accusing the international community of inaction, especially the U.S.
From here, I ask and I demand that the American president, Mr. Barack.
This is the Syrian National Coalition spokesperson, which is the front man for these rebel groups, or at least the ones that subscribe to this coalition.
Obama, as the head of the country that has the strongest presence in the international community, to be responsible at a personal level as well as his country level.
The UN has sent its high representative for disarmament to Damascus to persuade the government to let chemical weapons inspectors to the site of the latest alleged attack. Every second counts, experts say, if an investigation is to have any chance of success. Fred Plykin, CNN.
And that spokesperson for the Syrian rebels was speaking from Istanbul, Turkey. Well, coming up on the other side of the break, we will have our guest, and then later in the show, we're going to look at some of the information coming out about the Syrian weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons attack. Who's pointing fingers at who? And at least some sources are saying they know where the weapons were launched from. And we'll be telling you all that information and more. But first, as I said, on the other side of the break, we'll be speaking with Gray Tirico Caceros, Soros Justice Fellow and Florida Enforcement Organizer of the Florida Immigrant Coalition. You're listening to The Morning Edge here on WWPR. 1490 AM.
This part of the Morning Edge is brought to you by Callens, Little, and Delgado, practicing personal injury, criminal defense, and family law. Call 941-749-1446. 941-749-1446.
I may be crazy, but it just may be a lunatic you're looking for.
Save now, $5 a pill for Viagra or Cialis in 32-count generic packages. Compare $5 a pill to up to $25 in the U.S. Save On Meds pharmacies have been importing safe, reliable medicine to U.S. customers for 9 years. Get generic Viagra and Cialis for $5 a pill with confidence. Call for a free quote and info. It's Save On Meds, 888-6969-363, 888-6969-363.
Sarasota is home to a true gift, the Posture Clinic of Sarasota, with Dr. Mark D'Amato, 4450 South Tamiami Trail. Dr. D'Amato is a veterinary chiropractor, treating horses, dogs,
or your favorite four-legged friend. First and foremost, animal chiropractic care is not intended to replace traditional veterinary medicine. Complementary care is a type of care that works with your vet, and certainly not instead of them. To find out more information, call Dr. Mark D'Amato at 941-927-7009. That's 941-927-7009. Oh, and by the way, Dr. Mark treats two-legged patients, too.
With the
sharpen your edge. Call the Morning Edge with your comments at 941-745-1490. That's 941-745-1490. You can find your Morning Edge any time of the day on demand at themorningedge.podomatic.com.
This is Henry. Augie is out on assignment today, and will be back on Wednesday with us, but we're carrying on here in the meantime. And right now we're joined by Ray Tirico-Caceros. She is Justice Fellow and Enforcement Organizer of the Florida Immigrant Coalition, and we have to get to that right away. But first of all, Ray, thank you for joining us on the Morning Edge this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, well, I mean, there's a lot just in the title right there, but I'm so curious, what is an enforcement organizer?
I deal primarily with detention issues within the immigration context, so many cases that are of deportation detention usually come through me locally.
Okay. So, but getting more into the actual words there, the enforcement organizer, are you enforcing the laws that restrict the law enforcement and what they do, or
enforcement just comes from the terms of the different programs that exist locally, which we call local enforcement, specifically in counties where there is police and ICE collaboration. So enforcement just kind of encompasses that specific theme, and that's what I deal with primarily.
Somehow I just visualize you with as an enforcement organizer with this glare in your eyes and a stern look at the people that aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing. But what is the Florida Immigrant Coalition?
The Florida Immigrant Coalition, based out of Miami, is a statewide coalition comprised of different groups across the state, primarily with the purpose of making sure that there is dignity and equality across immigrant communities, and obviously we far reach to other communities as well, all people of color.
How did they come to, these different groups come together?
The groups, I mean, just through the fact that many of them have very, very similar visions or provide services to the same communities that we work with, reach out to us, and we're able to come together and collaborate in different campaigns. More specifically, currently we're collaborating on the immigration reform campaign.
And then also, I see you're a Soros Justice Fellow, and also through the Open Society Foundation Fellow. How does that work as either a bridge between these groups or between the larger purpose?
Well, the Open Society Foundation is a national foundation, and there's definitely national networks and doors that are open, and through that I've been able to learn a lot of different tools and have a lot of resources at my disposal that I can also bring back to Florida and my local community so I continue the work that needs to happen.
Okay. Now, you were born in Chile, but you came to the U.S. at the age of 7, according to the bio I see, and you lived in Naples, Florida, so you're right down the road from us, more or less.
Yes.
And before you became an activist, I mean, just as a young woman, was there a sense of awareness? Was this something outside the normal preteen and teenage experience that you brought you to where you are today?
Of course. I came to this country not knowing how to speak English, and so many people actually may be hearing me and may think, oh, this person has no accent, but it took me a long time to be here where I am specifically, not just around that, but to really incorporate myself into society. I live in a community that's also very conservative, and I was one of a few number of Latino kids in our school. And so I was very aware from early on that I was different, not just obviously linguistically and not just physically, but obviously racially as well. So that has also brought me to a lot of the places that I've kind of come through, and obviously currently employed with the Florida Immigrant Coalition, just because obviously my immigrant experience and the place that I live in.
We're speaking with Gray Torrico Caceres. She is Soros Justice Fellow and Enforcement Organizer of the Florida Immigrant Coalition. The website is floridaimmigrant.org. We'll be linking to that on the podcast site, but you can also just go to floridaimmigrant.org to find out more about the work there. And, Gray, we'll have time to get into the bigger issues, but to just keep the human face or the human voice to the topic, so why did you come to the U.S. at age 7? I know you're coming with your parents. Why did they bring you to the U.S.?
Well, we were from Chile, and for 17 years, and not just in my country, but in many different countries, we had dictatorships. Augusto Pinochet was a dictator for that period of time, and the economic strife that we felt, and obviously the social turmoil that also happened right after his fall, brought us and led us, at least my parents, led them to make the decision to come here because there just was no way for us to continue. And it's interesting, many folks also come to this country for the many same reasons, and it's interesting also to note that the U.S. government has also played a lot of the different, has had a lot of hand in how many dictatorships and how many governments are created and fall. And so in my case, in our case, in Chile, the U.S. government actually endorsed Augusto Pinochet. So a lot of it is actually, there's a lot of backstories there, but we ended up coming here, and you know, again, we came to Naples, and that's how we came, you know, we are actually still here. So.
And, you know, the common perception is that people come to the U.S. as agricultural worker immigrants. Were your parents professional people, or how, what did they find for themselves when they arrived?
My dad is a public accountant, was a public accountant in Chile, and my mom was a sales agent as well. And when they came here, my mom ended up becoming a housekeeper and my dad a construction worker. And they're still trying to, after, you know, and again, we came undocumented. We overstayed our visa. My parents are still adjusting their status. I was undocumented for 15 years. I've since then legalized myself, and all that time they held very honorable jobs, honest jobs, jobs that actually kept, you know, putting food on our table, as a construction worker, as a housekeeper. And that's what they're trying to get out of currently.
And how did you legalize yourself?
Well, I fell in love, and I have been with my partner for 8 years. And 3 years into our relationship, he proposed. And so we were able to go through the process. And it's a very hard process for folks who have never gone through it. The scrutiny that is placed on people who are actually legalizing through marriage is very, very hard. The bar is set very, very high. You have to go through different interviews. We went through 3 different interviews. You have to provide specific documentation of being married in the country and making sure that it was a valid marriage, and all different things. And so that's how I became to legalize.
And for people that don't know, because I actually had a friend that was in this situation, I mean, it is some intrusive questions that they ask, and to the detail of, I guess, in separate interviews, you know, like, which side of the bed do you sleep on?
Oh, yeah, of course.
And which, you know, after you think about it, it is a telling question, but not really anyone's business, I guess, other than for this purpose. So to segue into the broader issues from your individual story, but for the rest of the family, was there ever a time where they were in fear of their freedom or their being deported?
Of course. I mean, you know, again, I mean, this is a very recent process for us, the legalization process and adjustment of status. And so it wasn't until recently that my parents obtained their licenses. And so all this time, you know, we've been living in fear. And I also, again, I was first a legal permanent resident, now a U.S. citizen. I also fear for them, you know, and my sister just recently qualified for deferred action, which was the program that the Obama administration enacted last year. And again, we're still in this process of at any moment, at least with her and my parents, while they're still in this process, they could be detained, you know, and luckily they have me to come, you know, to come, kind of, making sure that they're, you know, that I'm there with them, but it's still a long process. And obviously we're really privileged in this sense. And there's so many other people that don't have, you know, these possibilities, these opportunities to adjust their status. And this is exactly why we're talking about this issue around immigration reform.
And I'm sorry, how big is the family?
There's just four of us, including myself.
Okay.
And I guess my husband.
And what about for your parents? I mean, people don't think about these things to have a driver's license, to be able to get to work, to own a car. What kind of challenges do they face?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, we live in a community that's very rural. We live in a part of Naples that is still up and coming, and it's still developing. And so getting to work for them is about 45 minutes, and so it's a long commute. And that's just for everybody who technically lives where we live. And it's so hard. I mean, and we're also very heavily patrolled in this area, specifically because the police department actually collaborates with the Department of Homeland Security through ICE. And so there are officers on the street on any given time that can actually also enforce immigration status. So this is exactly why a lot of people, including my parents, for the longest time have been so scared to be driving. And you just hear stories of just horror and of just so much fear, a lot of people currently being separated because of these programs that exist currently.
So how do they drive now?
They drive now because they have licenses now. So.
And how were they able to get those?
Through me. I was able to petition them. And again, for folks who, you know, we can go a lot into immigration law, but for folks who don't know, the only way for a parent to be petitioned is by having at least a son or daughter who is 21 years or older. And so I'm 26, and I was able to petition them because I am a U.S. citizen. So it actually kind of breaks down the myth of having, you know, there's this, I guess, there's this word that they say, anchor babies, that it, people come here, have children, and it's through that you can gain legal status, and that's not the case. You have to be 21 years or older, unmarried, to actually have a way to actually legalize.
And then what happens now that you petition? What did you petition?
I petitioned for them to adjust their status, and they're going to be adjusting their status to legal permanent resident. My dad just became a legal permanent resident, and my mom is in the same process.
Okay. And, well, so all you have to do is come here, have a baby, and bang, 21 years later, you can...
Well, it's not that simple, though. It's not that simple. It's not that simple because I am one of the privileged few that was able to do that only because we were able to come here through a visa. We came in illegally. We just overstayed. For many people who come across the border, there is no way for them to legalize. And there's a lot of scrutiny placed on different ways that you can do that. Part of the petition and application is that I also have to provide income for my parents. It's not just as easy as saying, well, you can petition and stay here. You actually have to show, the petitioner has to show that you're able to support and sustain the folks that you're petitioning.
Okay.
So it's not that simple.
Okay, so to clarify then, and I was being a little bit flip when I said it, but I'm glad it caused this distinction. So you arrived legally. Your parents overstayed your visa. So that creates an opening for you once you become the citizen to go ahead and... So if you had come here, I'm trying to get the distinction here. If they had come here legally, you were born here, you would have already been a citizen when you turned 21. You could have a petition to have them come in as have changed your status, correct?
And,
now,
and that's if that's considering again putting the possibility that if the parents remain in the country again, 21 years is a long time to wait, you know, strategy, you know, holding that strategy down for legalization is, you know, for many people, it's not even an option. Many people are going to get stopped or detained before that, you know, so it's really hard to say, well, 21 years, well, yeah, that's a long time.
No, I understand that. But what I also am trying to get to is, but if they had, say, been just a agricultural worker that came across the Rio Grande seeking work illegally, then those options wouldn't have been open to them.
Okay. Exactly.
So I don't think people really know the nuances of that law, and I'm sure you come across that quite a bit. So when you're out in the community in Naples, that is where you spend most of your time, correct?
Yes.
Okay. What are the broader issues that you see happening, how the different communities react to each other, how the law enforcement hinders the criminal activity or doesn't hinder the criminal activity? How do people adjust to that whole situation? How big is the undocumented community, would you say, down in Naples as a percentage?
Well, there is no way to know. There is obviously one thing that we do know is that 25% of the population in Naples is Latino, and that's grown drastically over the last 10 years. So we're seeing a booming demographic, not just in Naples, but in Lee County, which is Fort Myers. And that's just across the board, right, in areas where you usually see a very homogeneous population, you're going to see now more diversity. So there is no way to know how many undocumented folks are, but the immigrant community is huge. And how folks deal with this, I think, is different ways, right? There's folks like me who have fixed status families where you have a couple of people who have legal status, folks who don't. And, you know, and you do your best to make sure that you are doing everything you can to make sure that folks who don't have status are protected, making sure that people know their rights in case it gets stopped. And very, very easily is, for example, don't share, you know, you have the right to remain silent, for example, until you have a lawyer so that you can, with legal advice, be able to move forward in case you're detained. Many cases, I'm also doing that in the community where I'm training and letting folks know about these two different programs that exist, because people don't even know that the police actually collaborate with ICE and they're in our jails. Our jail, actually, Collier County Jail, acts like a detention center. So people can get lost there for months at a time because, you know, that's a detention center. And actually, Collier County gets a kickback. For every single person detained, they get a kickback. So obviously, they're generating profits as well as the detention centers. They're getting money off of the people that they're detaining. So it's, again, it's a never-ending circle. It's also, again, profit-making. If you're one of these corporations or these companies like CCA, the Corporations of America, and Geo Group, which run the two different detention groups in Florida, you're making millions of dollars by deporting folks. In BTC, it's $160 a day for people who are detained, and they have 700 beds filled.
That's what the state pays them?
That's what the contract for DHS pays them. The Department of Homeland Security has contracts with these private companies, and that's what they get paid.
All right. Let's go to the phone lines. We have Pat on the line. Go ahead, please.
I just wanted to ask your guest if she felt that the goal of these people who come to help us do the work, would they really want to stay here, or wouldn't it be better to give them like 6 or 8 months visas and let them go home for a while and then come back and do this on another visa thing like they did during World War II, instead of they all feel that they have to come here and work illegally or stay here?
Well, I think there's definitely a couple misnomers here. I mean, yes, immigration has actually been cyclical. As long as we've had immigration laws, and again, just for folks to know who don't know the immigration history, we've seen various groups of people been demonized throughout U.S. history, starting with the Native Americans, and they weren't even immigrants, but starting from then on to the Japanese, into the Irish, into the Mexicans, and now into the Latin Americans, it's been a constant demonizing and xenophobic, specifically immigration laws that have been in place to do that. So we need to understand that before we actually say these people are coming here. Well, these people were once Irish. They were once Italians. They were once Japanese. So it's been different folks throughout history. Obviously, the groups of people now coming in have been different. And I think we also need to talk about the root causes of migration, why people come here. Like I said, the U.S. government had a great hand that they dealt in Chile. And that's true for Haiti. That's true for Nicaragua, El Salvador, Honduras. So a lot of the different foreign policies have also driven a lot of people here. And that's specifically because that's how the U.S. has made it so. And lastly, I think people really need to understand how immigration law works. It's not as easy as just saying, let's come in and then come out. It's been extremely hard for folks now to just come in and come out like they did back then. Now because, again, how people are being criminalized just for the fact that they're coming in and working, because it's so hard to legalize as well, I think people are also under the interpretation that it's so easy to just come and come out. And, again, the economy runs on immigrants. So just very simply put, if people don't want to look at it as a moral standpoint, let's look at it economically. It makes sense. We can't deport them 11 million people that are here. It makes sense for them to continue being productive and for us to find a way to legalize.
Well, but I think my point is that maybe they don't, that a lot of people, and I'm not saying just Hispanics, but they don't really want to stay here forever. They left their families wherever they came from, and they would like to go home and visit, which now they do not have that opportunity, because if they go home, they have to come back over the mountain again or something. When I was in Arizona and studying this, they are treated terribly, and they can't even go home to their family. Like when the Irish came, they came as a family for the most part because of the famine in Ireland. So I think, we're being unfair to these people by not letting them have the opportunity to go home and visit their family and come back as on a visa or as an interim thing as they're waiting for their status to be made a citizen or not.
Okay, Pat. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
I was just going to say I agree with you completely, Pat, in terms of needing folks to go back home. I understand that. I haven't seen my family in years, and neither have my parents. And I am one of those folks that, like I said, I've lived here for 20 years. I actually call this country home as opposed to Chile. So for many folks, that the reality is that our countries are no longer home. Okay, so I felt in terms of the visa going back and forth, I understand that. I do agree with the legalizing part because we need to figure out a way to legalize folks who have been here long enough, who have family and community ties here in this country. And I have friends and family, and a lot of the percentage of folks that I work with actually have people that have lived here and worked here for so long that they no longer have any ties back except some family that remains. So I think that's where I agree with you on that.
All right. Thank you, Pat.
You're welcome.
We're speaking with Greg Torrico Casero. She's Thoreau's Justice Fellow and Enforcement Organizer of the Florida Immigrant Coalition. The website is floridaimmigrant.org, and you can find out more there. Do you have a few minutes, Gray?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So let's follow up on Pat's thoughts there. With all the talk about the immigration reform proposals that are up there in Congress and the different forms, it seems like the media's focus is on how to legalize the people that are already here. But as far as what Pat was talking about, for future labor needs, are there any proposals that allow for a more freer flow of labor back and forth across the border?
The Senate proposal that was passed in, I think, late June, it did include agricultural provisions. It also included ways, because this is the thing. The current guest worker programs do not work, specifically because they offer no coverage and protection for workers specifically. And for folks who know a little bit about the mechanism of guest worker programs, the worker is actually tied directly to the company. So if the worker, for example, feels exploited, feels that they're getting their wages cut from them, feels harassment if they're a woman, whatever, there is no way for actually there is no way for them to actually, bring that up, because there is a fear of retaliation from the employer of cutting them completely. So the current Senate bill actually offers some protection. It also offers a way for farm workers specifically to legalize if they meet certain requirements, and they can become legal permanent residents if they meet requirements of work and things like that. So yes, it does is included in the Senate bill.
We have an open phone line at 941-745-1490 if you would like to get a question or comment in before Gray has to leave. That's 941-745-1490. And Gray, what is the status of the immigration reform movement in the Congress? Is it likely to happen? What's likely to be the shape of it, if so?
So currently, the House is in recess until this week and the next, and they're going to go back to Washington, and we're hoping that we see some type of comprehensive bill coming out of the House, just as we did in the Senate. The House will not take up the Senate bill. They've been really, really vocal about that. What they're thinking is that they want to push out a piecemeal approach. But again, there's a lot of different, consequences if they do that. We feel that the best way to really, really move forward effectively, not just for folks who are currently in the situation, but for all of us, including citizens, the best way is to really come to the table with a way that there is a pathway to citizenship so that people can come out of the shadows, can be productive, can continue contributing, and there is a way that we deal with what many Republicans and Democrats want to do in terms of the enforcement provisions. And again, we definitely don't think that the border needs to be continued in terms of militarization. We have enough. I don't know if people have seen the current proposal from the House, but they are doubling the number of border agents that the Senate bill already includes. They want to do more. And I know that at least the question for me is, how much more? I think the border is pretty secure, and so I don't know how much more we need to throw in. And that money could be used for something else completely different, like the education for our kids, so many other things that we need to do. So that's where we're at.
Well, Gray, I don't think you're going to win the argument with someone who doesn't think the border is secure. That seems to be more of a almost a dogma for the opponents that the border can be secured and that it isn't secure. I would point out to people that Israel, which is pretty tight on border control, if you know what I mean, has 10,000 illegal immigrants a year coming across their border, and that's a much shorter distance to oversee. But I do want to take up one of the other adversaries' arguments. You know, we have a lot of conversation right now about what is a livable minimum wage and the idea that it needs to be well above $10. You know, one of the ways that you control the price of a commodity is by controlling the supply of it. And if for all the talk about how we need labor, and you know, I would say that your parents are an example. They didn't go work in the fields. They did have to work at a lower position than what they were used to in Chile. But you know, those are jobs that had been done by natural citizens 30, 40 years ago. And so what about the argument that there is just too much of a labor supply to keep wages up at the level that they need to be?
You know, that's an interesting point, and I think I always go back to what happened in Arizona in 2010 when we had SB 1070. A year or so after that, we had copycat laws, and in Georgia specifically, the case was that they brought the copycat law to Georgia. That year, about 20,000 crops were left to rot because the farmers that they that actually had saw the consequences of the bill that happened said that basically they put out ads for everybody to come out and do the job. And again, it's the whole thing around, well, they're taking our jobs, they're doing this. Well, nobody came. A U.S. citizen, legal permanent, nobody came. And all those crops were left to rot.
Well,
and I'm just saying that's one specific example. The other one is, I think that people don't understand how much, I think the business entrepreneurship is also coming from immigrants. I was reading a stat the other day about half of the folks that are currently in small businesses are all immigrants, and they're also creating jobs. So I think there's a lot of different things that we can say around the economy. that we can go back and forth. But you're right. I don't think that I'm going to win the argument for folks. I think the point is here that we can have a healthy debate. And for folks who do want to learn more, maybe you're in the middle aisle, those are the folks I'm trying to reach out to. Because for the folks on the other side, the far right, again, this is, kind of just talking to a wall. That's how I feel about it.
Well, and unfortunately, I don't think we're going to get an objective view of that, because with the point you talked about with Georgia with the agriculture industry, the counterpoint would be, well, what happened with construction jobs and wages in the construction industry? And I haven't seen any stories about that to have a counterpoint to it. But I guess we'll have to wait for that for another chance to talk. We've been speaking with Greg Torica Caceros. She is Soros Justice Fellow and Enforcement Organizer of the Florida Immigrant Coalition. The website is floridaimmigrant.org. And, Gray, thank you so much for spending the time with us this morning and the extra time. And good luck with all your work.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Coming up on the other side of the break, we'll look at the stories coming out of Syria and try and sort through what we can triangulate on the truth, if you will, here on the Morning Edge.
And you sharpen your edge. Call the Morning Edge with your comments at 941-745-1490. That's 941-745-1490. You can find your Morning Edge any time of the day on demand at themorningedge.podomatic.com.
Sarasota is home to a true gift, the Posture Clinic of Sarasota, with Dr. Mark D'Amato, 4450 South Tamiami Trail. Dr. D'Amato is a veterinary chiropractor, treating horses, dogs, or your favorite four-legged friend. First and foremost, animal chiropractic care is not intended to replace traditional veterinary medicine. Complementary care is a type of care that works with your vet, and certainly not instead of them. To find out more information, call Dr. Mark D'Amato at 941-927-7009. That's 941-927-7009. Oh, and by the way, Dr. Mark treats two-legged patients, too.
With the animals,
come to a little piece of tropical paradise, just a few minutes from the white sand beaches of Anna Maria Island. Come to the Parrot Inn, studio and one-bedroom unique tropical-themed vacation apartments, full kitchens, Wi-Fi, and cable TV, all just 20 minutes from Sarasota, 45 minutes from St. Petersburg. Come for a getaway weekend or a getaway week. The Parrot Inn, 8621 Cortez Road, Bradenton. Call 877-372-7768.
This part of the Morning Edge is brought to you by Callens, Little, and Delgado, practicing personal injury, criminal defense, and family law. Call 941-749-1446. 941-749-1446.
What's interesting, George, talking to a U.S. official on this, is you get the sense the belief is not that military action can be decisive here.
Right.
That it's really military action because you need to do something because of what the president said.
And our military is rightly leery of making a gesture. They're not in the gesture business. And they have a feeling that's what they would be doing, lobbing cruise missiles, these standoff weapons, into a country to make what? Us feel good or look good? The president on CNN this week said the use of gas is going to require America's attention and hopefully the entire international community's attention. Now, some people believe in the Tooth Fairy, the Easter Bunny, Santa Claus, the Loch Ness Monster. Others believe in the international community. It's a fiction.
But isn't there a credibility question, though?
Yes.
I mean, if the president draws a red line and says, this cannot happen.
I mean, it's almost as if God is taunting.
Because
the
Iran is watching this. That's the big thing.
Yeah,
Iran is watching this right. Little dance of deadlines and red lines, and they're deciding it doesn't mean a thing.
Absolutely. So I want to move to the.
All right, George Will on ABC this week, just yesterday, and trying to make sense of all this talk, and the people are all upset, and the talking heads are sucking their thumbs, dragging their knuckles, depending on their point of view, and we hear headlines like George Galloway in Britain of the Respect Party saying that if there's any use of nerve gas, it's the rebels that use it. If there has been use of chemical weapons, it was Al-Qaeda who used the chemical weapons. Who gave Al-Qaeda the chemical weapons? Here's my theory. Israel gave them the chemical weapons. Well, you have a theory, but what's the evidence? Well, you know, that's the good thing about theories. You don't always have to have proof. Syria lets UN inspect gas attacks. Washington says too late. Syria agreed to let the United Nations inspect the site of a suspected chemical weapons attack Monday. But the U.S. officials said that any such offer was too late to be credible. Well, is that the case? Well, it can be also hidden in the idea that you can mix the sarin gas with normal crowd control chemicals, and you'll have a very difficult time proving that a sarin gas attack. So it's questionable whether they ever could have been able to determine one way or the other, and it doesn't determine who sent it. I had another report from the Telegraph of, rather the Guardian of London. David Cameron and Barack Obama moved the West closer to military intervention in Syria on Saturday as they agreed that last week's alleged chemical weapons attacks by the Assad regime had taken the crisis into a new phase that merited, quote, a serious response. Well, and then CBS News reports that the Pentagon is making the initial preparations for a cruise missile attack on Syrian government forces. It says initial preparations because such an attack won't happen until the president gives the green light. And if the U.S. goes in and attacks another country without a U.N. mandate and without clear evidence that can be presented, then there was a question in terms of whether international law supports it. Well, you talk about George Will speaking to the international communities. And then, of course, we at the beginning of the show, we had this allegations of Syrian rebels using chemical weapons against the actual Syrian state troops. And we see the video of a relatively empty warehouse and boxes and materials labeled made in KSA, which is a Qatari German company. So what can all be done about this? Well, the idea that nothing can be done wouldn't do any good. Well, there is the principle of retaliation and deterrence. And I'm not coming down on that as the best option, but the idea that say, oh, well, nothing can be done, well, maybe not so much. You know, over the last few weeks, we've pulled together stories from Euronews, from Russia Today, from Debco, the right-wing Israeli website, sources, and whether it be the Telegraph of London or the Guardian, from all around the world right here on the Morning Edge, which trying to take different points of views and see what makes the most logical sense. Well, the Israeli website, Debco, which can be a source of misinformation for the right-wing, just like the New York Times can be, if you remember Judith Miller, we can look at that, and they are actually getting quoted by the French daily Le Figaro. Took their report and reported it as their own on August 23rd. If you were listening on earlier in the week, that Wednesday or Monday, you would have heard us talking about it and giving accreditation to the site, but Le Figaro didn't bother to do that. Anyway, the Debco site states that Russian pressure, required that Syrian's President Assad consolidate the chemical weapons in three sites. It also says that both Israeli and intelligence determined where the assets were launched from. And so the idea is, one, you could strike the Syrian unit which perpetrated the poison gas to basically have an eye for an eye kind of retaliation. Two, you could destroy the Syrian's army bases where the three weapons depots are, or rather two, and three, you could get both of those. And they point out that with the three weapons depot, you risk the chance of spreading the chemicals across the U.S. Well, we'll take this up and more on Wednesday. Augie will be back on Wednesday as he finishes his assignment at an undisclosed location. And we'll be back on Wednesday at 9 with another Morning Edge.
I was only having fun.